Blog Talk Radio. with the British invasion in 1964 through today, the number of successful artists who have elevated to rock legend status in the world of rock and roll is unparalleled for popular culture. As growing numbers continue to rock well into their golden years, many rock icons are reflecting on their careers by releasing memoirs and autobiographies, while others in their actual farewell tours. However, with the loss of David Bowie, Glenn Frey, and Paul Kantner in the same month of January of 2016, the Timmons brothers will reflect on the career of these three icons and the address the issue that January 2016 may become the benchmark month and year we will later remember as the time when the loss of rock legends of natural causes began to reach an unprecedented pace. As the Righteous Brothers said, if there is a rock and roll heaven, you know there's got to be one hell of a band. It will be a band far better than we have here. The Timmons Brothers tonight are my guests, John and David. It's Bowie, Frey, and Kantner, January 2016, a reflection on their past and rock's future. I'd like to welcome John and David Timmons to the show.
How you doing, John?
John,
I'm doing
thanks
great.
So much. Appreciate it. I think the topic's going to be a good one tonight.
You know, guys, I was doing some research the other day on a show that I did, and somebody wanted me to look into it, and I looked into it, and it was 2009, and I don't know when our first show was, but it's got to be somewhere in that area, maybe 2009, 2010. So we've been doing this for a while, so I just really appreciate it. It's a great thing to have you guys on.
Oh, it's always good working with you, John. Like I said, it's always good to talk to another guy that loves rock and roll as much as John and I do.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it, like we talked a little bit off mic, David and John, about how sad this is. It's one of those shows where, you know, you come into it with a little bit of a heavy heart because of the loss of these three incredible musicians. But you also look at it like a celebration because they were all three of them were incredibly amazing at what they did. They broke ground. They did things that no one else did. You know, David Bowie, Glenn Frey, and Paul Kantner all stand all in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and all, I believe, and will all stand forever as rock and roll icons. Now,
well,
what
think of, you always
yeah, go
think
ahead.
Of David Bowie, John, as Bowie was a chameleon. No area of music it never trapped Bowie. And you get think about it, to me, though, when he did Ziggy Stardust for the very first time, it was at a Save It a Well festival in July of 72, and they said when he came out, the fans were in awe. They'd never seen such a character. That he became Ziggy from the album, and they said everybody was just, for 5 minutes, just taken with that character. And I think probably at that moment on, Bowie became the icon he was.
Yeah, I believe what you think about John and David, when you think of David Bowie, you think of theatrical rock, because when you hear music, it does something to you. And I would just want to talk about John, really good choice on that song Cactus by Bowie. I mean, that's truly a rock song. That's pure rock, and that's got a little bit of connection, Ohio connection to it. That's, we started the show off with the Pixies, who Francis Black, or he calls himself Black Francis now. He'll call himself all kinds of different things. He wrote that song. And our Ohio native Kim Deal was in that band. So that's pretty cool. But I really like that, and I like the contrast. That's why I played the two. I like the contrast in the two songs. But they're still both rock and roll songs. I mean, if you don't get – if that doesn't touch you in rock and roll, it's like in a guttural way. It's like, you know, intellectually – it's not maybe that high, but man, when it starts playing and that bass comes in, then the drums come in, and it's just like, you know, that's a good selection. So I'm really glad you picked that one.
Thanks, John. You know, it's the kind of song that I think of if you're an athlete and you're in the locker room, you want to get pumped up for a game, how it kind of starts slow and then it builds up and then it starts, you know, getting that bass and that piano. It's one of those kind of songs like, hey, I'm ready to play the game now. You know, you can just
yep.
see an athlete having on their headphones, getting ready to hit the court or go on the field, you know.
Yeah, and I think that it's one of those things where if people aren't that familiar with the Pixies, they were and still are to this day. They tour. I'm not sure if Kim tours with them. But, you know, that's just – it's just rock and roll. Now, what you were saying, David, when David Bowie got on stage, it was just rock and roll. But now it was theater. Now it was eye candy.
Definitely.
Now it was – okay, so your senses – are overwhelmed by the music, but now what's going on stage is kind of like the first time I saw Alice Cooper. I thought, you know, wow, there's just so much going on. I didn't even know what to think.
It's just like they say, John, if you remember well, in one of the songs, it's the sight before the sound. And when he came out, it was just the way he was. He had a stage appearance no matter what. When he came out, he was very flamboyant about what he would do, and some of the things he would do would be outrageous, but the key thing was he was the one that would open up the door for Peter Gabriel, open up the door for Kiss, Alice Cooper, Mark Bolan. He was the one that would set the standards for what I call theater rock, and all the others can say they put some polish to it. But David Bowie was the very first one, especially when he would do Space Oddity. That was just Mick Ronson, before he passed away, said the first time they played that live on stage, said that the whole audience was in awe. And he said, I was in awe myself when David did it. And he said they hooked two wires to him, and he floated above the audience. And they did not see if that was safe or not. They did that in Odeon Hall in London. And Mick Ronson said, I wasn't for sure if David was going to make it or not, but he flew above the audience, and he still did this. And you can imagine now the groups that he has influenced. It's just so important. And you mentioned the Pixies. How well I remember them. They was a big article on them one time in Cream magazine. And like I said, they was a well-known band, but David had an influential thing about him. And even when he had to change his name to David Bowie, a lot of people don't realize his real name was David Robert Jones. And because of one of these monkeys, he changed it to Bowie. And I hope Marcy isn't listening, but
yeah,
I think David Bowie outdid a little bit of Davy Jones.
Yeah, and some of the influence also that I think is important to say would be Lou Reed and the New York Dolls.
Yeah.
I mean,
Ian Hunter and Mott the Hoople.
Yep. Oh yeah, they got their big break by doing a Bowie song, and that's what, you know, I think that happens a lot of times. Bands are good and they're really good, but when they get a great song behind them, it just like catapults them into another area. And I think, you know, All the Young Dudes was that song for Mott the Hoople, but it was one of those songs where now you associate, you know, that with the band. But that was a Bowie song, and it's kind of interesting. What do you guys think that one of the and before I forget it, we'll do our Stump the Timmons Brothers here in a minute. But what do you think was one of the important things with Bowie as he grew? As like you said, David, he was a chameleon, and he went from one area of rock to another. But he didn't seem to have any fear. It didn't seem to bother him too much. Because you see bands that think, oh my gosh, you know, I had a song and this hit number one, so I better have another song that sounds just like that, and I'll, you know, milk this until I can't milk it anymore. But he didn't seem to do that. He didn't seem to want to do that. What do you guys think of that?
Well, John, I think that Bowie was never satisfied with the hit formula and always looking for more innovation. He wanted to be creative and was willing to push it to the limit. And I think that's why you're talking about his influence. Well, you can make an argument. If there's not a David Bowie, I'm not sure you have a Madonna or you have a Lady Gaga, et cetera. I mean, Lady Gaga did that set at the Grammys and truly admitted it was David Bowie's from the Aladdin Sane that really got her into rock and roll and to try to be flamboyant, you know. And Bowie pushed it to the edge. He was doing this in 72 and 73 when we're just barely coming off, just 2 years, 3 years away from Woodstock and the festivals. And, a lot of them were starting to wear just jeans and flannels. And suddenly now here's this guy wearing these big boots and these space outfits and the haircut and the makeup, you know. I mean, really.
Just your average person.
Exactly. Even the day we see it as kind of outrageous. But look at 1972 and 73 when he's doing this. And then he could have stuck with that formula for many, many years. And he retired. That Ziggy Stardust, it was just really when it was starting to get big was when he decided to retire that, I guess you'd call it, character. And then when he was going in, he wanted to go more rock and roll, he recruits Mick Ronson, gives him more of a rock sound. And then he wants to go more to a space, kind of a techno sound, so he gets Brian Eno. I mean, he would keep getting different kind of musicians. He wouldn't just stay with one band and be like, hey, this is the sound I'm looking for. These are the musicians that I need so that I can accomplish this.
Then he brought in Adrian Belew when he became the Young Duke. And that it's amazing to me. He went right into what I call rhythm and blues. When you listen to Golden Years, I remember when he was on Soul Train and got Don Cornelius couldn't help but start dancing. Remember that, John?
Yeah.
We watched it that day, and no thing would trap him, and he wasn't afraid to experiment. Now, there was a couple albums like Station to Station where he and Brian Eno, and John, I'll let you answer this more than this because you listened to that album. You can tell John what you thought of that when you first bought it.
Well, I was I got to admit, what really had me become a Bowie fan was hearing The Rise and Fall with Ziggy Stardust there. But then the album I really enjoyed was Latin Sane. But as I kept liking in Diamond Dogs, but then he takes this big change, and I'm like, when he comes out with the album like Low, it's just so different. And even though I was a Bowie fan, I was like, boy, I'm not sure I would have bought this if I wasn't a Bowie fan, you know. But then again, that's why he wanted to be the person who would be creative. He could innovate. He wasn't going to settle for what was already working. And I'm not sure how many artists could have a number one, well, I don't know if it was number one hit, but it was definitely top five, with a song like Fame, which was so different than anything, and even since then. But particularly when it came out in 1975, and what a weird combination. Him and John Lennon happened to get together, and John gives him this idea about kind of overlooping this guitar sound that really makes the song. And so Bowie would be like, whatever he could adapt to his sound, he was always looking for other people to play with him in his bands. And when I saw him live, I was always the one live concert I did see him was in 1990, and I was just amazed with how he was so really into the audience, and he was really kind of a personable guy, and he would talk in between songs and laugh and joke. And I thought to myself, what a far cry from when I saw the movie of Ziggy of the Ziggy Stardust movie, where he's almost like this alien and he wouldn't hardly ever smile or talk to the audience, but yet I'm looking at the same person.
Yeah.
Well, John, you know what? The key thing during the reality tour, he was very open with that one, too. I have the DVD of that, and I watched that. Very relaxed with his audience, wants his audience to get involved. I remember he asked him, you're not told to have a sing-along. Of all songs, they did all the young dudes, and they all sung along, and he was very emotional about some of these songs. You could see a tear come down his eyes. And the key thing I'll mention about him, he wasn't afraid to be a group member. When he joined 10-10, he wasn't the lead singer. He was the keyboard player and guitar player, and same way with Nine Inch Nails. So he was never afraid to do what he had to do.
Now, I got to ask you guys the trivia question before you talk about it. So I got to get it out there because you're dancing all around it. But I'm going to ask the trivia question. This is our Stump the Timmons Brothers. And what we're going to do tonight is you're going to be against each other, too. So it's going to be John against David. It's going to be John and David against John. It's going to be all of us against each other. But I'll say the question, then I'll ask David first, and then I'll ask John, and then I'll give the answer. Okay, so this is our first Stump the Timmons Brothers, and we talked about David Bowie's glam rock phase and his Ziggy Stardust phase. his that era. Now his next one, when Bowie entered into his next phase, it was called one of these four. I'm going to list four names, and you tell me which one was his next phase. It was his Under Earth phase. It was his Plastic Soul phase. It was his Pop Goes the Weasel phase. Or it was Jazz in Tights phase. I'll repeat them one more time. Under Earth phase, Pop Goes the Weasel, Plastic Soul, or Jazz in Tights. David, what do you think?
I'm going to go with Plastic Soul.
Okay. John, what do you think?
I hate to be boring, but I guess that was the one I was going to go for. But I do like the choices here, particularly Pop Goes the what? What was that again?
The Weasel.
Okay. I just really like that. But I think I'm going to go just because I know he went kind of for the sound from Philadelphia. He really got into the sound of Black Soul America. So I'm going to go Plastic Soul.
Okay, you guys are both right. Ding, 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 ding. Yay. Good one. Yeah, I used my imagination on those.
John, that was good. That was tough. But, you know, John, you brought up some good points there, even in that question. There again, that's how versatile he was. He was, you know, most artists, you hit on the head, John, you've had songwriters on your show stuff. Some of them say, well, I got a formula that's going to work. I'm going to keep it for a while. But what happens? You end up in the discount racks after a while. And the key thing is, he wasn't afraid to experiment. And one of the songs I always liked, and it never sold well till 9/11, was Heroes. Heroes took off after 9/11. That song, We All Can Be Heroes, the New York Fire Department played that over and over at their stations, the New York stations that time, after everything. And when Bowie was one of the artists that came at night, along with The Who and a couple of members of other bands, and Bowie performed that live at Madison Square Garden for all them families. And when Heroes came out, hey, John, you can quote me on this, it didn't chart that well originally, did it, John?
No, it didn't. I'm not sure that it was actually even meant to be a big hit single, but it became more like an anthem for the police and for the fire department.
Yeah, and it's still this day. And even when I'm getting ready to go to a meeting stuff, I put on Heroes myself because I need it at times.
Well, you know what? It's a good segue. Let's play it. So my guest tonight is John and David Timmons, the Timmons Brothers Rock Historians. You can go on their website, timmonsrock.com, and we'll talk more about what they've got coming up in the future. But let's play this David Bowie Heroes, and we'll be right back after this. We Can Be Heroes Just for One Day. That's David Bowie. Tonight's show is the Timmons Brothers, Bowie, Fry, and Kantner, January 2016, a reflection on their past and a rock's future. My guests are John and David Timmons, rock historians. You can go on their website, timmonsrock.com. And guys, what would you like, how can we put a nice bow on this one? Bowie, get it? That was funny.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
How can we, I'm so clever, I surprised myself. But how do we do this? How do we sum this up? I mean, the guy was amazing. I mean, he hit, you saw all the tributes out there. I mean, it hit all of the news, you know, things. It was on the news. It broke through. It was an amazing thing. What, I'll ask you first, David, what were the things that you remember about David Bowie, and what would you want people to remember about him?
The main thing I want people to remember about David Bowie, that man in the studio was a musical genius. He knowed what he wanted. Rick Wakeman said it best. A young 20-year-old Rick Wakeman was in the studio with him working on Space Oddity. He said, working with a young David Bowie at the time, he said, this man, he could tell at 19 years old, this man was very talented. And his influences in music, even at this time, his music will still be played, John, I would say well into the future. He was never afraid to challenge something new. And a lot of artists, to be a young artist now, and I've listened to some of the young artists on your show program at times, they can never be afraid to try something new. And David Bowie set that standard, I think. Say, don't be afraid to do something, because you always, you're going to may have failure, but not be afraid not to try it. And he proved at his point till the day his death on that final album. And like I said, he's just always going to be iconic. And to me, he's always going to be one of my favorite all-time artists.
Well said, David. Well said. John?
I think David Bowie comes to mind if Woodstock and the Rolling Stones and Give Me Shelter at the Altamont concert supposedly led to the end of the 60s. I think Bowie slammed the door with his influence throughout the 1970s in a completely different direction he went with the music. And that would just end up, we would later find out, just a piece of the pie of what he had to offer after the 70s. And it was, at first it was all flash and glamour, and then we realized there's a lot of substance there. And now we look back on his career, we actually realize he wanted to be just a singer-songwriter, but he couldn't get anyone to sing his songs, and that's really what led him to, like, I'm going to start recording these myself. I like these songs. They need to be made. And eventually, as we know, as you mentioned Monte Hoople earlier and some other artists, they would start taking his songs, but that was really what motivated him to become the singer. He was going to be fine with just being the songwriter and letting somebody else get the credit. So he certainly ended up being not only an excellent performer on stage, but, you know, he took it to the theater and actually did take it to cinema with several movies. So just an incredible talent that went beyond the rock and roll world into pop culture.
Yeah, that's good. That's good stuff. It's just like a lot of, you can look back, and we're going to talk about Glenn Frey next, but you can look at these musicians and they kind of, I don't know how to even say this, but they kind of rode the wave. Things were going a certain way and they would ride the wave right along with it. Like, I look at the Beach Boys, and that's another pun, a wave, the Beach Boys. But they, I'm on fire tonight. Yeah, but when they were going down this wave of popularity, and Brian Wilson was like, "Whoa, stop! Let's do this." And it was like Mike Love and some of the other guys thought, "No, why would we want to do that? We're popular. This is cool. This is making us money. This is good. We don't want to ruin anything." And I think when you see musical geniuses like David Bowie and Brian Wilson and people like that that thought, you know, I'm not really concerned about that. And I'll have to say I'm not the biggest Glenn Frey fan, but I definitely respect his career and everything that he did. But when you get into Paul Kantner, now that's somebody that I think is one of the best. He was not only, guys, did he say he didn't care what people thought. He was a revolutionary. And he he was like, his thoughts were like, I'm not really concerned about what you think. Let's play this. So I think that you guys did great job on the first one, David Bowie. Now let's go into Glenn Frey. We'll play a little music from Glenn, and then we'll come back and talk about him, and then we'll do Stump the Timmons Brothers. And give me one more chance, guys, to see if I can stump you guys. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen, but we'll give it another shot. And this is John Tuck Radio with my guests, John and David Timmons, and we'll be right back after this. And then we'll discuss the career of Glenn Frey.
There ain't no way to hide your This is a new ballad called River of Dreams.
And yes, it did come to an end. My guests are John and David Timmons. We just heard a couple of songs from Glenn Frey, Lion Eyes and Take It Easy. And beautiful. I really like that live rendition. Sounds really cool. Let's start this off with my Stump the Timmons Brothers. Are you guys ready?
We're ready.
Jump right into it, John.
Okay. We might as well. Okay. So we all know that Glenn Frey was from Detroit, Michigan. Born and raised in that area. Grew up in Detroit, Michigan. Glenn was in several bands before the Eagles. I'm going to name four bands. You tell me which one he was not in. I'm going to name four bands. You'll tell me the band that Glenn Frey was not in. Okay?
Okay.
Let's go with John this time. Are you ready?
Okay.
The first one is The Four of Us. The next one is The Debuts. The next one is The Mushrooms. And the last one is Heavy Metal Kids. So it's Four of Us, The Debuts, The Mushrooms, Heavy Metal Kids. Which one was Glenn Frey not in?
Okay, I'm leaning toward Heavy Metal Kids because I got to figure this was like pre-Eagles, and I don't know, heavy metal started becoming a more of a popular term. I'm leaning toward that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. I know he's in a group called The Mushrooms. I've actually heard of that. That one I knew of. But I'm leaning toward here, Heavy Metal Kids or Debuts. I'm going to say, I just don't think the Heavy Metal Kids. I don't know. Maybe it's a trick question. I'm going to go with Debuts.
Okay. David, which one do you pick? You want me to repeat them?
I am going to go with Heavy Metal Kids because I just don't go with Glenn Frey. I might be tricking myself, but I'm going to go. Me and John's going to split up on this one, so I'm going with Heavy Metal Kids.
He was in The Four of Us. He was in The Mushrooms, and he was in The Heavy Metal Kids.
Oh. Well, John beat me. John beat me.
I got lucky.
Well, John, you're hitting me, but took 1 point. It was a good trick question, John, because it just didn't go. It's been what his menu was for me. I know he did play with Bob Seger once, so I should have thought of that.
Well, my initial reaction is just, I like you said, David, I didn't think of heavy metal with Glenn Frey, and I knew that term. If it had to be pre-Eagles, you're looking. Gosh, at least 1970 or earlier, you know, and I was trying to remember when heavy metal started becoming more of a popular term. I guess it was starting to use, what, 68, 69, maybe?
Yeah. Well, it put you 1 point ahead of me, too.
Okay. Well, by luck. Okay. That's a good one, John.
Yeah. Thanks. And I think that's pretty cool because you look back and it, like you said, John, that you've heard of the Mushrooms. You listen to the Mushrooms were more of a 60s garage band and really good stuff. I mean, and I hadn't had a chance to listen to anything. I don't even know if there's anything out there for the Four of Us or the Heavy Metal Kids, but the Heavy Metal Kids were one of his last bands he was in before he went on into California from Detroit and went into that direction. But a lot of people probably don't know. You hit on a great thing, David, about how that he was from Detroit, and he was on Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. He played the guitar, a rhythm guitar, and sang backup vocals on that song.
With Seger, and a lot of people don't realize that. And it was Bob Seger that recommended him to go to the West Coast. He said that you got talent, and so that's where he got hooked up, basically, with Linda Ronstadt and met Don Henley and Jackson Browne. And so he got there and everything, and they performed a lot together, and eventually him and Jackson Browne was in the same apartment and would jam at time. He'd hear Jackson Browne playing his piano early in the mornings getting ready, and he got liking what Jackson Browne was doing, and Linda Ronstadt even said herself one time that she noted it was getting to the point where Glenn Frey and Don Henley was wanting to do their own music. And she could see a point where they even came up and tour one time and said, we want to break away and try doing our something on our own. And at the same time, Randy Meisner was playing with the Stone Canyon Man with Ricky Nelson. And so he was basically doing this before after he'd left Pogo in between there. And so you could see this form. And Bernie Leadon was looking for what he wanted to do after the Flying Burrito Brothers. And it was all by accident how they met the other two. They were performing with Linda Ronstadt, and Bernie Leadon wanted to jam on stage with them. And lo and behold, he said, I got another friend that wants to play. But I always got to say this about Glenn Frey and the Eagles. They was the most dysfunctional band that walked the earth. and I'm very, very truthful. I've followed the Eagles for years, and Glenn Frey's worst enemy was his temper. He could never get along with other band members. Everybody thinks of Hantley, but Glenn Frey had his good points. But if you didn't do it the way Glenn Frey wanted you to do it, Randy Meisner made the best comment. He said, what you did, you hid in a corner and hope he didn't throw something at you. so that's what Meisner said himself. So that was one of the conceptions. He wasn't always a saint, and he wouldn't claim to be. And his adventures with Don Fellner, and I'll let John explain the story about Don Fellner. John, you got to tell that one about the Senate race.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. There was some politician, they were in Los Angeles in 1980. I think he might have been a state senator or something, but it was for something with the environment, some kind of cause. And he was thanking the Eagles at a press conference for plan and helping to promote this cause and really appreciate you being here. And he went around to shake each other's hand. He went to Don Henley and of course, then, thank you very much. And Glenn Frey, thank you very much. And I went in, Randy Meisner, thank you very much. Then he got to Don Felder, and he goes, thank you, I guess. And because Felder did not want to do it, he felt that in the real rock and roll, you just be worrying about your music, not worrying about some kind of a cause, politics, and he didn't want to be there. and in the interview from the History of the Eagles, Glenn Frey is saying, well, I overheard him say that. I thought, well, how dare you make a comment like that when this guy is thanking us in public, you know? And he said that night they played on stage, and there's a recording of it. And in between songs, you can hear him like, wait till this show's over, Don. You're a real hero. I'm gonna beat you to a pop. And he's like, try it, Glenn, try it. And you can hear it in between songs, you know.
And he's singing and, Take It Easy when he's doing that.
And exactly. And
that's
here was
funny.
Joe Walsh saying, he goes, and they call me dysfunctional. I was out there thinking I was the straight guy, you know.
But that's amazing. John gets his point, John. It's just amazing about Glenn Frey. Everybody blames Hanley. Well, another story about the two of them. It was the Hell Freezes Over Tour. Well, they're playing that in 94, and they're all back together. And they're playing. Well, Don Fellner catches wind of this, that they're getting 60%, the rest of the band's getting 40%. Well, Glenn Frey tells them, we kept the band's name going throughout the 80s. You guys didn't. And like I said, he had his points about him, but sometimes Hantley and him both, and the battles between him and Don Hantley were very, during their solo careers, got very wicked. There was a stretch where him and Hantley did not speak to each other for 2 years. And there was a time when Hantley wanted to reform the Eagles. I want to say this was in 1990, before the Hell Freezes Over Tour. Well, he's practicing with the band Hantley's on end. Frey says, I don't want to commit yet. Well, Don Hantley told him, said, we don't need you at the time. And so, like I said, I always thought Aerosmith was dysfunctional. I think these were the all-time dysfunctional band. And Randy Meisner, John, tell John the story about Meisner when he came on the stage after a drinking spree, what Frey did to him.
Oh, you know, Glenn Frey, it wasn't just Don Felder. He would have his arguments and conflict with almost every member each at as far as a different time. Now, with Randy Meisner, he said one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. It's hard to get mad at him. He was friendly. I really liked him as a group mate. But he said Randy would love being having a night on the town with the women, boozing it up, having a great time. And there was one time, he says, right before the concert, he comes in. You can tell he hasn't been sleeping. He's been up all night. And he comes over to Glenn, you know, that Ticket to Limit song, Glenn, can't do it tonight. I just can't get that arranged. I can't get up there. He's like, what do you mean you can't get up there? He goes, man, I've been partying so hard, I just can't reach those notes. He goes, people are paying big dollars to hear Take It to the Limit. That's why they come here. Do you think I like playing Take It Easy every night? Of course I don't, but I know people are paying their big money because they want to hear it. You will sing it. He goes, well, you can tell me I'm going to sing it, but I can't hit the note, and I know what I can do. And I guess with Glenn Frey, he said that really was the beginning of the end for as far as being Meisner, being a member of the Eagles, because he was just so upset with him that he, when it came to Glenn Frey, he wanted everything to go just right. And if something was not going on, he, you know, I think, you know, often I notice when I've been telling people about this show is going to come, and Glenn Frey, the first thing I get from people talk, loved Eagles music, but I hated their egos. And I would hear this from people. Yep. And Glenn Frey was probably the, as far as the poster boy of the ego, more than any other member.
He
and,
was the prima donna. He of the
and,
Eagles.
What a talent. But, John, I know a lot of people, and you admit it yourself, you're not that much of a fan of Glenn Frey. You might like the music, but it was his personality. It could be kind of abrasive, and the members would just when you thought you'd do something to please him, he'd find something wrong with it. And
even at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, when they all – this was all the original Eagles come back to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to play, all the members. Don Feldner would not shake his hand. he said, I will play on stage. And then Bernie Leadon said I looked at Frey. He said, I shook hands with Hanley, but he said I had the notion to spit in Glenn Frey's face. And it's amazing how this band could and have all these heads, and yet he and my brother John put out the best. You had to be picture perfect with him, and if you weren't, you were in his doghouse. And Joe South even said one time in an interview when he first joined the Eagles, Randy Meisner warned, he said, Joe, if you're going to get drunk, make sure you're drunk 3 days before we have the concerts. And he even warned him, he said, because it is not going to work. And Timothy B. Schmidt said, I used to feel like the odd guy out when I joined. He said, they would get backstage and want to fight each other. And he said, I just find a neutral corner and stay there.
Yeah, I love Timothy B. Schmidt. I mean, what a talent, Poco. And I read something too, guys, where he said that, you know, he was so excited to be in the band. And then once he got in the band, it said there was so much tension and so many weird things going on. But he just wanted to play music. And he said when they got to playing, they were awesome. But it was like everything outside of that was very tense. And he just wouldn't let himself get involved in all the drama and all that stuff. He would just was the you know, consummate musician. He would come to practice on time. He would do everything they wanted him to do. He would play everything that, you know, was supposed to be just the way it was. And that probably fit really well into Glenn's personality.
You draw up a good point on Timothy B. Schmidt, too. Timothy B. Schmidt, when he first joined him, Don Felder was always known as a party animal. Well, Timothy B. Schmidt was more on the quiet side.
Yep.
And they were playing Las Vegas. I read this in a book about the Eagles. They were playing Las Vegas. Don Feller said, Timothy, he said, you got to see the real world. And Timothy said, after four or five hours of Don Feldner, he said, I don't know how Don survives, but he does. And he said, but Timothy B. Schmidt, though, what amazed me, even for his after the Eagles split up for a while, he played on every Poison record. And he says, I don't get credit for it, but couldn't you see him in the background with Poison?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
That's pretty wild.
That is.
He played all the guitar work.
And he's just an amazing bassist, and he has a really high voice too. I mean, he could hit the high notes.
Yeah.
Maybe they
yeah.
should have had him play. What Meisner couldn't hit those notes that night, but
I don't think he, you know. And it was like, as a matter of fact, it's really ironic. It was almost like from the Farm Club, Poco. We get Randy Meisner. Hey, we're replacing Meisner. Call up the Farm Club, Poco. We need Timothy B. Schmidt. Call him in. You know.
Then Meisner
you know?
Goes back to Poco. Remember, John.
That's what I'm
Poco.
Saying. Because it was the same kind of high voice, you know.
But one of the best things about Glenn Frey, and I love the Showtime special, Don Henley is rehearsing. And even though Don Henley was supposed to be his best friend, he told Don, he said, if you can't make up the rhythm, the backup on the drums, we can replace you. And Don Henley fingers him right on the video. And you talk about a close band. and that's the real Glenn Frey. You can't sugarcoat it, but he was still, I got to say one thing, he was still a great artist. And I put him in the David Crosby Club. And you get in that club, that's a unique club.
Yeah, that is. That was a great analogy, though, about the calling him up from the Farm Club. It's like, you know, Timothy it's like sitting there waiting on the bench. Oh, it's my turn. I get to join the Eagles. And make all this money, because I also read guys where Timothy B. Schmidt was talking about he had played, like you were talking about David, all the different bands and stuff he's in, but I don't think he was making Eagle money. You know, he was money, but he wasn't making money like Eagle money. And that's where maybe that had a part of it, because they're huge. I mean, you talk to people and they put the Eagles in this whole little area by themselves. You know, it's like,
and that was Glenn Frey's problem. Glenn Frey thought he was above everybody else and looking down on all the other Eagles. I think he flew with extra wings probably.
Flew a little too high maybe, David.
Yeah, but you just mentioned Timothy B. Schmidt. Jim Messina, when they were all together in Poco, it was Rusty Young had told Timothy Schmidt when he replaced Meisner, he said, you got the ability. But Timothy B. Schmidt said, I always thought between the rest of the members of Pogo, he said, I felt kind of out of place. But then his guitar work, though, he did with Poison. He did a little bit of work, I want to say, with another band that people were shocked with. He did a little bit of work with the Cars and in the studio. But you're right, John. He didn't get into big money until he got with the Eagles. But then when you joined the Eagles, it was like walking into the Adams family. Watch out.
You get a pretty big check, though, I would imagine. I don't know how they worked that out, because I always wondered. That would be something we ought to do sometime, guys, is get some people that were in the music industry on and have them talk about that, because I just wonder how much people got paid. And bringing Timothy B. Schmidt in, he would probably get paid a lot of money, but it wouldn't be, you know, Glenn Frey money or Don Henley money or any of that.
Exactly. Well, every Eagle, if you weren't Don Henley or Glenn Frey, and the other Eagles make good money, but I know John will agree with me this. If you weren't the top tier, it was always 60-40. And I get thinking about that. Could you have seen the Beatles been satisfied? John Lennon and Paul had said, George Ringo, we'll put your songs on the refrigerator and we'll make 60-40.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing to me. But I got to say one thing for Glenn Frey and the Eagles, that music's going to last forever. No matter what you think of what he did and his temperament and stuff, he still was a musical what he wanted, but I don't think I could have been in a band with him. I think I would have hit him in the head of a guitar before it was over.
That's the beauty of rock and roll.
You know, John, we're talking about the money that they make, and Glenn Frey, I'm trying to remember the year. I might have been 99. But Don Felder came back to the band for a while. And David alluded to it about, well, he got word. He didn't know at first how the contract was set up with Don Henley and him making more money than the other members. And he said, this was Glenn Frey. He said, it got to the point Don was still a good guitarist, but Don just saw the money we were making and not thinking, hey, I'm making $12 million. They're making $24 million. I was like, done. You're not going to make $12 million anywhere else. Be happy with it. Stay with the band, buddy. And and he said he felt or just couldn't get over it, felt he should have had equal pay. And it was kind of a mutual departure. He's like, if I can't get the pay, I'm leaving. Well, you know, we're not going to give you the pay, so you can go, you know. And Fry was right. I mean, Schmidt has said that the money he made with the Eagles was like something he just couldn't imagine.
Right. Yeah, I heard that.
I got
yeah,
one more Eagles story I got to tell. I got one more. This one here, this one's a good one. This was November 24th, 1972. They was calling it the Western Woodstock at the old Memorial Stadium where the Rams used to play. Well, only 38,000 people showed up for it, and they thought they'd have 100,000. Glenn Frey crossed paths with Mott the Hoople, and it didn't click. I read about this in a Cream magazine, and he was amazed. He said, here comes out these five guys in very colorful suits and stuff, and he said, and Ian Hunter and him had crossed paths with the Eagles, and they played on the same bill that same night with Elton John. And the Eagles and Glenn Frey thought they should have top billing. And it was Elton John that ended up getting top billing. And from that point on, Glenn Frey would look over every contract. If I don't get top billing, our band don't play. And so I guess you would call him the dictator of rock and roll.
Well,
yeah, it sounds
like John
he had a strong opinion on everything, didn't he?
A strong opinion. And I mean, somebody can check on this, but I believe I've read somewhere that they were the only band that did not want to appear on American Bandstand, and Dick Clark wanted them, but they were like, only if we are the only act on the show and you don't play any other music will we come on Bandstand. You know.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you know.
That's why they never appeared on too many shows. It's pretty obvious.
It's probably at home counting all of his money.
Yeah.
He should have. You know, when I think of them, I always think of the old Holly song, King Midas in Reverse.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
But it's amazing. Like I said,
If I can find one other connection here, and I know people don't think too often connections between David Bowie and Glenn Frey, but one that we probably would not say other than the songwriting and the influence, both of them got into acting and had, you know, fairly some roles that fit them well. I mean,
right.
Glenn Frey there in the 80s, I remember watching it. Gosh, I think it was Miami Vice was the show he was on or something?
Yep.
Yeah, you know. And,
with his white suit on.
yes, exactly. And I mean, it's just pretty wild to think that. And then he would make like appearances in movies. You know, one of my favorite movies was that sports movie with Tom Cruise, Jerry Maguire.
Yeah,
Glenn Frey played a role in it.
Yeah.
Hey, you know? John. Remember the now, John? You probably remember. You remember the cover they made for the Outlaws? They're all dressed up like cowboys. Well, Jackson Browne dressed up like him for that album cover, and he said Randy Meisner said I was so scared to get my picture taken with Glenn Frey with a six gun on, and he said I didn't want to say nothing wrong.
Oh my, that's funny. I would just shoot him dead right there. Oh, that's great. Good stuff about Glenn Frey. So we got one more person to talk about tonight, and that it would be my favorite of the three. And it's just wow. This is a person that, you know, I think we got a lot to talk about. It's going to be different because David Bowie was more in the rock and the glam rock and a more of a pop star. And then, you know, Glenn Frey was, you know, that country rock. But let's – our next person to talk about is Paul Kantner. And we're going to play a song by Jefferson Airplane, and then we're going to be right back and we're going to try to stump the Timmons Brothers, and then we're going to talk about Paul Kantner. So this is John Talk Radio. My guest tonight are John and David Timmons, and we'll be right back after this.
When the truth is found to be when you dive, don't you want
And we're back with John and David Timmons. Our show tonight is talking about Bowie, Fry, and Kantner. And I think Mickey Thomas could have hit that note Randy Meisner couldn't have hit, too, guys.
I agree.
My goodness. I couldn't hit that note if, you know, I don't know what you'd have to do to me to get me to hit that note, but it would be, it was one of those things where you hear that song, and it's like, wow. When I heard Jefferson Starship live this summer, David Freiberg played, he sang that, and he hit those notes. And Yeah, and it was like, and he's 72 or something like that. Yeah,
well,
so,
he's up in years.
So it was amazing. And I just want to say, you know, to see them play and to see Kantner play, the only reason we went there, it was at a free concert in Springfield, Ohio, and during their arts, their community arts festival. And when I heard that they were playing and I knew that Paul had been sick and had a heart attack and wasn't touring, and I told Marcy, I said, well, let's go anyway, you know, just to go hear him. And then as we're sitting there, we see this guy standing in the background smoking a cigarette back behind the stage, and everybody all set up. And Marcy's got, you know, she's looking, and she said, is that the guy you're looking for? And I said, well, let me see. And I looked, and there he was. And I thought, oh, my God.
Wow.
That's so awesome. Yeah, and he
sure
had
that wasn't a it sure wasn't a joint.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what it was, but it was one of those things, guys, where it was like, you talk about a rock and roll icon. You talk about having that presence about him. He just stood there. What an amazing rhythm guitar player. You know, it's like he didn't play leads. He never played leads. He was a songwriter, and he was a an innovator. That had no problem sticking it to the man or whoever. Now, I've heard stories similar to what you're talking about, Glenn Frey, that Paul wasn't the warmest, fuzziest guy in the world. That he was kind of that way, where it was, you know, real serious about his music. He didn't play around when it came to his music. He was, you know, this is the way it is, and this is the way we're going to do it. And he kept that whole spirit of Jefferson Airplane going for so many years. But before I forget it, let's play Stump the Timmons Brothers for the third time tonight. And here's our last question.
He's ahead of me 2-1, too.
I know. You gotta get it, David. You got to get this one. Okay. So Paul Kantner met Marty Balin in San Francisco in 1965. He met him in a bar. I'm going to name four bars, and you tell me which one of these four bars was where Marty Balin and Paul Kantner met. Okay?
Okay.
Here they are.
Okay. The first bars.
Yep, there are four bars that they met in 1965. The first one is the Bay Area Pub. The second one would be the Drinking Gourd. The third one would be Flanagan's. And the fourth one would be Amazing Graces. So it's either
Gourd, would be tricky.
Bay Area Pub, Amazing Graces, Flanagan's. David, you go first this time.
You know, I think it's a trick question. I could just see both them singing Amazing Grace. I'm trying to figure this out.
I
am going to go with Amazing Grace because I think it's a trick question. And okay. I'm going to go with that. And I might be wrong, but I'm letting my ESP develop this one. So I'm going to try for that one.
Okay. John?
John, Bay Area Pub is in San Francisco. It is the Bay Area.
Yep.
But I tell you, I really don't know, but I'm going to take the name I like, the Drinking Gourd. It just sounds like a neat place to go.
Well, John Timmons is right. You get 100%.
Oh, no. I can't live on stage with him now during the trivia shows now. It's going to be tough. 3-1.
Oh, this
but
is.
I can still see him. Couldn't you see them though singing Amazing Grace? I liked it.
Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to picture it. Okay, yeah. That's pretty
but
good.
Good
question.
They met at the Drinking Gourd, and I'm pretty sure that Marty Balin owned that bar. He was the proprietor, and Paul Kantner came in, I think, was going to play during that, you know, that period of time. So, yeah, how cool is that? I mean,
there's a club too, John, in San Francisco called the Matrix, which it was there, and Jefferson Airplane would perform a couple of the early shows there. It was introduced a group called the Charltons that never got heard of, but they was always like the house band there.
Yeah, and I remember that.
And they would play there, and Jefferson Airplane experimented with a lot what we would call psychedelic rock air, and one of the two members sitting there watching them before they formed their band was Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir. And they was watching there, and the Grateful Dead would perform there 3 months later, I want to say in August of 65. And
wow.
So this Matrix Club and the Charltons, I think what hurt them, they were already experimenting with basically what Cream would be doing about 3 years later. But when you brought some good points there, I could still see them sing Amazing Grace. So I can't get that out of my head now.
Well, I think you said the right word there. They were doing a lot of experimenting.
Yes.
Yeah. And I will just leave it at that. But that was one of the things that about the music. And I'm such a Jefferson Airplane fan that I listen to their music, and when it goes into Starship or Jefferson Starship, and then it went into Starship, and it's Mickey Thomas still is touring under Starship, so he plays Mickey Thomas's Starship, and then if you see Jefferson Starship, they're still playing. David Freiberg is in it. Then the rest of them are, you know, just musicians that played with Paul, but they're playing more of as a tribute band now. But I still think it would be worth seeing them. But
is Cassidy still playing with them anymore?
No, he doesn't play with them, but he plays with Hot Tuna with Jorma Kaukonen.
I know there was a Paul Kaner and him. They had one of them argument moments. I don't think they even speak to each other. I was wondering if they. Well, I know he's gone now, but that situation happened years ago. I know, so I just wondered.
Yeah. Well, I've got tickets to go see the Marty Balin band at Jorma Kaukonen's Fur Peace Ranch down in Pomeroy, Ohio.
Very good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to go see them, Marcy and I, are on July the 16th. So that's being an airplane fan, I couldn't pass that up, and seeing Marty Balin's band play. And then the next night, we're going to get to hear the new Riders of the Purple Sage at the same place.
Oh. You will love them. I'm a big Dave Nelson fan. He does a great job with them. Yeah.
Yeah, they're just like when we started the show off, David. You were talking about, you know, getting to see these guys before something terrible happens to anybody,
yes.
And and exactly with these guys, because they're all what we mentioned with Marty Balin and I think Kantner was 72, maybe somewhere in there. So, yeah, when they're out there touring. I would recommend anybody listening or anybody just do what you can do to go to these concerts to hear these guys, because it's going to be maybe too late someday. So what do you think, David? I just asked David real quick. What do you think that Paul Kantner had that made him a legend, and what was it about his music that
I got to say this, John. One thing about him, he wasn't afraid that if there was a certain kind of riff he wanted to do, he would do it on his Barry Talon with the guitar. You could see a heavy influence he would have on bands like the Yardbirds, and Emma would come over here. And you could talk to a Jeff Beck, you could probably even Eric Clapton. I think the guitar playing would stand out. And he was the first to do the psychedelic. I think he was influenced by watching the Charltons play a lot in that same club. But the point of it is, his guitar work, I always liked the song. I listen to White Rabbit. I get a kick out of that song every Easter anyway. But it's a good song.
it does put you in Easter spirit, doesn't it?
Okay. Yeah, it does. But he wasn't afraid. And John, you put up a good point. J.D. did. He was a leader of the band, and I think you had to be a leader in a group like that because you had so many stars in that band.
Yep.
Somebody had to be willing to step up. different from the Eagles situation where Glenn Frey was the almighty and you follow me. But with him, he wanted you to be a pacist, keep us as a unit, but let's not get to the point where the music process, he was willing to listen. Let's say if Bellin wanted to do experiment with something, yes, we'll give that a try. So he was more willing to listen to stuff, and you listen to these songs, and like I said, he had his own work, and for me, I count him and the Grateful Dead for the San Francisco sound. To me, that will always be the San Francisco sound. And I'll let Brother John take up from there.
Yeah, well, what's your opinion on that, John?
Paul Kenner, if I can compare it to Glenn Frey since it's been in the show, I think that the big difference was Kenner, I think, had direction with his music and didn't care what other people thought. But he was willing to put aside his ego because how many different lead singers did he work with and let them come to the forefront? I mean, from Mickey Thomas to Marty Balin, the Gray Slick, it was Signe Anderson. I mean, that's just four I can think of. There's probably more. And yet he was the common thread through all those years of the Jefferson Airplane into the Jefferson Starship. So there's something said about him being kind of the stabilizing force of the band that really was its most creative force within the band. And so I think that's really something to be said about that because he did write a fair amount of the songs.
Yeah, he did. And I think you made a great point because you look at the Eagles and all the different opportunities for ego that was in the Eagles, the same egos were there in Jefferson Airplane, Jefferson Starship. I mean, you had Jorma Kaukonen, which is one of he's still to this day one of the best guitar players there is. He's just incredible. And then you had Marty Balin, who went on his own and did this tremendous solo stuff and wrote all of his music. And Jack Cassidy and all these different musicians. And Gray Slick, who, if you guys, I don't know if you're get on the Facebook and with Grace, but she's always updating her Facebook, and she drew these amazing. She's an artist, and she drew these amazing pictures of Paul Kantner and of the airplane, and it's right there. I mean, it actually, if you're rich, you can go out and buy some. They're really expensive, but they're beautiful, and she's captured that, you know. And I don't think she's played music for a while. And she's pretty much said, you know, that's in another time and all of that. But I think that I look back at that music, and I think, David, you mentioned it, and I think you did too, John, about the psychedelic era and that 66, 67, things started changing musically. The airplane were like – They were more commercial than the Dead. The Dead were like, they were out there, and a lot of people don't really understand how incredibly talented the Grateful Dead were. They were incredibly talented musically, but the airplane were more commercial, I think. They hit more that they could put their music on radio, and they could put like White Rabbit and Somebody to Love and these songs. And then Kantner just kept evolving, you know, okay, let's do something. He did some real spacey stuff, but he also did very commercial songs and that were a hit.
One story I got to tell about Jefferson Airplane. They was playing at that outdoor festival. Well, hey, John, am I right? Was it Marty Bellin that got knocked out?
It was the Altamont of with the Rolling Stones.
He gets knocked out. Yeah, and they were out there playing. Well, one of the Hell's Angels would not let him get up the stage, and he gets knocked out.
Oh my!
And they tell the Grateful Dead members, "You don't want to play this place." He said, and I still can't imagine how Jefferson Starship felt about that, or Airplane at the time. And that is why they would never play too many outdoor festivals after that. They were always at fear that would happen again because they were invited. I believe, John, they were invited to Woodstock, and they didn't come, did they?
They played Woodstock.
Yeah,
they played Woodstock. They played Woodstock. Yeah. Then they thought it was going to be the same when they came to L.A.
They thought it was going to be the same peace, love.
Same friendly atmosphere, which it wasn't. And the Rolling Stones did not tell them that. And I know in one of our programs we do the history of rock, and we were very vivid with that, where he tells, I think it's Jerry Garcia he tells that to, ain't it, John?
It is. It is. And they are arriving to perform, and I think it's the member of Santana's talking to him. He said the Hells Angels getting out of control. They just knocked out Marty, and the airplane had to leave the stage. And that's when Jerry Garcia said, "Well, we're not going on. We just aren't going to play here." But one thing about the Jefferson Airplane, I don't know how many groups can say they did this. They played Monterey Pop Festival in 67. They played Woodstock, August 69. They played Altamont, December 69. Played the Isle of Man Conference concert in 1970. All four are probably iconic outdoor concerts, and they may, and I'm not sure, but they might be the only one that played all four.
Yeah.
I think
you got a good point. Yeah, it was incredible. I think I read something about, and Marty was hurt pretty bad. I think when they beat him up, I think he had to go to the hospital, and that's one of the things that's so really amazing about it. Just a different spirit of music. There was that, you know, "Let's Get Together," which was a song that they did, and that kind of, you know, the Youngbloods did it, and that kind of, they played it at the concert I was with Kantner, but that spirit of that music is loving and kind and gentle. And
I have to tell this, John, about the Ed Sullivan story. Ed Sullivan had never heard of the Jefferson Airplane, but his producer said, "You got to put them on there. They sing a song about a white rabbit." Well, Ed knew it was getting close to Easter time. Ed does not know what Jefferson Airplane's white rabbit's going to be about. And so Ed introduced him. So there's some really big show, you know, and he introduced him. And Ed looked at him later and said, "That had nothing to do with the Easter rabbit."
Yeah, it had nothing to do with the Easter bunny. Well, guys, it's been great talking to you tonight. I really appreciate you guys being on. The shows are just awesome. And I just want to say thanks for, I don't know how many years, 6 years that we've been doing this?
Five or six years. Great.
Yeah, and hopefully we have five or six more. And what's your final thing on tonight's show?
Tonight's show is there's some great books being written by rock stars. They're reflecting on their years. I highly recommend go to your library or a bookstore and get some. You can get everything from Rod Stewart's memoirs to Jimmy Page, Paul McCartney. There's just a slew of them you can check out now or buy. And it's really interesting because we've never seen this. Rock and roll, the rebellious music, and these people are in their 70s and they're reflecting. And to survive a rock and roll life and be able to look back on it, it's got some interesting stories to be told. And highly recommend those. And like we said, when they tell you it could be their farewell tour, really go out and see them because it really could be the farewell tour.
Yeah, exactly. Well, David, you got about a minute. What do you think?
I think go out and see these artists while you can. Just like the Grateful Dead right now. A lot of the members on the road, go and see them. We're never going to have these iconic stars in the world of rock again, and go out and see them. And also, I got to add this. On June 11th, I got to outdo John on our live show. you got to go out and see them. And JD, you put up a good point. Go and see the legends.
Yep. Amen. We're going to, a big gift for Marcy, we've got VIP front row seats to see the Monkees when they play in Dayton.
Wow, very good.
Yeah.
Hey, John, I feel sorry for you. I'll be quiet.
John, can I mention, too, that updates on the Timmons Brothers, go to www.timmonsrock.com and see what we got going on this summer. For the latest on that, we are starting to get our summer schedule set up. And one show we know is definitely booked is there in Mount Sterling, Ohio, June 11th, on that Saturday. We will be doing there, and we also are in the process of continuing doing some reunions.
That sounds great, guys. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great night. Thanks for supporting John Talk Radio through the years. We'll be back. We'll do another show with John and David. And this song is, we're going to go out with a couple songs, but this is Jefferson Starship, "Let's Go Together." This is one of my favorite songs from them. And Jerry Garcia plays banjo on this, so pay attention to that. Thanks, everyone, and we'll have a great evening, and we'll talk to everyone later.
Wherever I go, there's always food. There's always
Let's go together. God.